We're holding on page 128 in Shabbos, Os Tzadik Vav. We started talking about Bris Milah, which is the main subject of our Perek. And the Gemara had said before that any mitzvah that the Jewish people originally accepted b'simcha, for example, Bris Milah, to this very day we do it b'simcha, whereas any mitzvah that the Jewish people accepted on themselves only in a quarrelsome way, such as Arayis, where they complained about it to begin with, then even to this very day there's quarrels involved whenever there's a chasana. So now, continuing in that same vein, by the way, I saw an interesting thing from the Chidah. He says, what's the point when we say adayin oisav b'simcha, that we still do the mitzvah of milah b'simcha? Why would we think that not? Why would we think it would have stopped at some point? And he says an interesting point. Gemara tells us in Nida, why is it, Taka, that a woman is tamei for only 7 days after a boy is born and 14 after a girl was born? So one point the Gemara says over there is because you don't want on the day of the Bris Milah that the husband and wife are still going to be upset. They have to be separated from one another. Like this, when he's tamei for only 7 days, in principle, she can go to the mikveh before they do the Bris. Now, says the Chidah, nowadays we don't do that. Practically speaking, what with all the halachos and everything that we have, it never happens that she's tahor 7 days after the birth. Nevertheless, we still do the mitzvah b'simcha, even though that reason that the Gemara mentions is no longer applicable. Anyway, so now, Os Tzadik Vav, Tanya, Reb Shimon Alazo Omer, here's another distinction between mitzvahs. Kol mitzvah shemosvi Yisrael atzman alayal misah v'shasa shmahad, any mitzvah that the Jewish people were mosin nefesh and ready to go to their deaths about it at the time of shmad, the times when the Greeks and the Romans and whoever were persecuting the Jewish people and forcing them to not do mitzvahs, kegoin avodah zarah u'milah, for example, not to worship avodah zarah, or for example, to keep the mitzvah of bris milah, adayin himuchzekes biyadim, such mitzvahs are still strong by the Jewish people. When it comes to avodah zarah, you have the line that the Alter Rebbe says in Tanya, that even a kalch of a kalim is going to go on mesidas nefesh for it. And mila, we have any number of examples in Jewish history of people who did bris mila under almost impossible conditions. Anyway, v'chol mitzvah shaloi masu Yisrael atzman alei lemisa. On the other hand, any mitzvah that during shas hashmad Jews were not mosin nefesh on it, they're going tefillin. Adayin himirupa biyodam. Such mitzvahs are still weak by them. And in what sense? The Omer Rabbi Yanai, tefillin tzrichin guf naki ke'elisha bal knafayim. Rabbi Yanai tells us that tefillin, we had this already earlier in the Masechta as well, this as well as the whole story of Elisha bal knafayim that we're going to tell now. We had it earlier in the Masechta as well, that tefillin require, you have to have a clean body while you're wearing them, like Elisha bal knafayim, where the Gemara is going to tell us now the story of the nest that happened with him in tefillin. So what do we mean, a clean body? My timer, my he, Amar Abaya shalo yafiach behem. Abaya says a person has to be careful when he's wearing tefillin not to pass gas in them. Rava, Amar shalo yushan behem. Rava says it just means that he can't sleep in them. In other words, that Rava would say, that not that Rava would say there's a problem with not that Rava would say it's fine to pass gas in them, but Rava would say a regular person is able to hold himself back from that. So the concern is only if he falls asleep. This is how Rashi explains it earlier in the Masechta. The concern is only if he falls asleep, then he may do that. But as long as he's awake, then we're not worried about that he's going to do it. The point is, though, so Rashi learns, in other words, we see that most people are not able to be careful with that. So the fact that Rabbi Yanai has to tell us that they require guf naki ke Elisha bal knafayim, implying that only Elisha bal knafayim was particularly careful with this, everybody else was not. So we see that mitzvah is weak by Jews, the particulars of the mitzvah. There are other Rishonim who learn, and in fact we had something about this earlier in the Masechta, where Tosfos says that it may even mean that b'chlal, Jews have gotten careless with that mitzvah. When we learned this previously in the Masechta on Daf Mem Tes, we talked about then, for example, how the Smag in his time, 750 years ago, went around in many communities in France and Spain and went on Mivtza Tefillin, going and talking in many kahilas over there and giving droshas, explaining how important it is to put on Tefillin, where people have gotten very lax at it. And in fact, he writes in his Sefer that many kahilas taka started putting on Tefillin after having been lax with it for a while. So here, according to that, the Gemara would be saying the same thing, that it's not one of those mitzvahs that you often find that Jews are very strong in, because they weren't mosin nefesh about it at the time. What's the story? V'amai kodele Elisha bal knafayim. Shepam achas gozra malchus roi mishmada Yisrael. One time the Roman government decreed a shmad, a general gzera of trying to outlaw and uproot Yiddishkeit. Chas v'shalom. And part of the gzera was shekolam aniach tefillin al roshay yikru as moicha. Anybody who puts tefillin on his head, they're going to peck out his brain. Rashi brings that the word yikru. I mean, is maloshin to nakir, like literally to carve out, or like to they would literally push it. They'd threaten to open the guy's head and pull and take out his brains. Because of course the head is where you put the tefillin on. So Marsha points out, after all, particularly they were against tefillin shel rosh, because tefillin shel rosh are worn out in the open, unlike the shel yad is usually covered with the sleeve. And you have the thing, you have the pasuk about it, the yoru v'ro kolamia oretz keshem hashem nikra alecha v'yoru mimeka, that when you're wearing tefillin the way you're supposed to, then all the nations will fear you. So of course the Romans had particular reason to be against that, and not to want the Jews to wear that. So therefore, they threaten this drastic punishment for anybody who does. Nevertheless, Elisha, who later on was called Baal Knafayim, didn't worry about that. And he went out into the street wearing his tefillin. A Roman official saw him. So Elisha started running away from him. And the official starts running after him. Kivinshi Gia Etzloi. Then when the Roman official reached close to him, not one made Oshay, then Elisha took them off his head. And he held them in his hand. Now we have two possibilities over here. Earlier in the Masechta, Tosfos discusses that the question, so why wasn't he continuing to be Moser Nefesh? If the whole point was, we're saying that he was particular to be Moser Nefesh, then why wasn't he doing it that? Why wasn't he leaving the tefillin on his head? And earlier in the Masechta, Tosfos explains that it's not necessarily, for example, we know the halacha is that you're not allowed to, at time of shmad, even if the goyim have one particular kind of shoelaces and Jews have a different style, a different color or whatever, you're not allowed to imitate their style. But that's when you have something where you're clearly acting the way that the goyim do. Here, to not wear tefillin, many people don't wear tefillin all day. So therefore, it doesn't look so blatantly like you're going and following what they're doing, and therefore he had the right to take it off. There is b'chlal a big machlokas we showing him on the question. We know, of course, you have the big three, Yehorek Val Yaver, Avodah Zarah, Gil Arayis, and Shvichas Damim, and we know that they're b'shas hashmad, you have to be Moser Nefesh for other mitzvahs as well. But yeah, does that apply to mitzvahs asay or not? So one point is that Tosfos says, Udiyu in the Masechta, maybe indeed you don't. So here, actually, Tosfos says, we see that even Elisha himself, we're saying the mitzvah of tefillin is weak by Jews, we see that even Elisha himself took them off his head rather than, and pretended that there was something else, rather than telling the Roman outright, these are tefillin. So we see that even he, who was a Mesiris Nefesh, he had still drew the line someplace. That's what we mean also when we say that the mitzvah of tefillin is weak by Jews, because you see that even Elisha was weak in that regard.
There's still no point from the word, I mean, there's some...
So one point is, Tosfos mentions that earlier, first of all, he was yotz in the mitzvah of tefillin that day. Second of all, also, other Rishonim point out, after all, when it comes to a mitzvah saseh, when you get down to it, they could be mevatel him from doing it anyway. All they have to do is throw him in jail and take away his tefillin, and there he's not able to be mekayim in the mitzvah anyhow. Therefore, you could argue there's less of a reason to be moser nefesh on it. By the way, this is very much Azman Grama, today's Tesvav Sivan, the day the Friedrich Ever was arrested, and we know what Herculean efforts he put in to wear tefillin, to put on tefillin over there, even while in the interrogation room, and they almost ripped him off him, and then when they took it away from him, he went on a hunger strike, etc. So there's different ways of understanding. In other words, again, when the Gemara is saying that the mitzvah of tefillin is weak by Jews, do we mean, yes, most Jews wear tefillin, but they're not careful about gufnagi? Or do we mean that many Jews are not even careful to wear tefillin all the time, and we see that Elisha himself didn't go the extra mile with it? Hakosev over here mentions also a couple of the various opinions on this point about whether to be moser nefesh on such things, or whether you're required to, whether you're allowed to, etc. So the Roman official says to him, "Mabi yodcha, what are you holding?" Amalei kan feyoni, he says, "Dove's wings." He opened up his hands for Nimtzuba Khan for Yona, and a mess happened, and they taka turned into dove's wings. That's why they called him Elisha, the one with the wings, to represent that this nest that happened to him. So the Gemara asks, Maishna Kanfa Yona de Omalev like Omalev Sharoifus. Why Epis did he mention dove's wings rather than other birds? Marsha explains, obviously, I have to say something, but so I can understand why he mentioned wings or feathers, but why Dafka doves? The reason is, Mishum de Damya Knesset Yisrael de Yona, because the Jewish people are compared to a dove. Shanema, as the Pasuk says, Kanfa Yona Nechba Bakesef, the wings of the dove plated with silver, the every seha and her large feathers are covered birakrak chorutz with yellowish gold. So the point is that the and this is referring to the Jewish people when they left Mitzrayim and they took a huge treasure of gold and silver with them. So the point is, what's the comparison? My yonazuk nefeha meginis aleha, just as with a dove, its wings protect it. Which, so Rashi over here explains, and he explains similarly earlier in the Masechta, that it means, unlike other birds, that when they fight off an attacker, they use their beak. A dove's beak is not strong enough to, it mostly uses its wings, it beats against the attacker. Tosfos earlier in the Masechta explains that it also means that the dove will fly away from danger, and even if it's tired, so it'll for a while it'll fly with one wing and let the other wing rest, as opposed to most other birds can't do that. So therefore, afisro mitzvahs meginas aleihem, the same way the Jewish people mitzvahs protect them, and therefore that's the comparison to dove's wings. Which Marsha says, in other words, now the Gemara has a long discussion in Sota about the power of Torah versus the power of mitzvahs as far as what it protects and saves a person from. One point the Gemara mentions over there, that it doesn't say that having done a mitzvah doesn't necessarily help save a person in the future from doing aveiros. It doesn't strengthen. Learning Torah strengthens a person's yetzer tov against its yetzer hara to make him less susceptible to do aveiros. Mitzvahs not necessarily. And here we see, going with what Tosfos is saying over here, that even Elisha didn't do quite right because he should have left the tefillin on his head, or he should have at least told the officer outright, these are tefillin, rather than pretending that there's something else. And then the Romans are going to think maybe that they actually succeeded in eradicating this mitzvah. So therefore, that's what we're saying, that the mitzvah of tefillin did not protect him from making that mistake. Okay. Well, specifically it was the tefillin shel rosh that they had it against, so b'pashtus it's only the one, but yeah. I mean, again, another way of explaining this gemara over here is because he was particularly careful with guf naki, which most Jews are not, then therefore he had this chus that now this nest happened to him. Okay, in any case, the point is we've established that there's something weak about tefillin that you find by Jews, as opposed to Mila and Avodah Zarah, where you find Jews are still strong with them Adei Yemazeh, because they were Moser Nefesh with it at the time. Further on, a couple of blocks later, it talks about you do a bris milah, of course, even on Shabbos when it's bismanai. Now you have the Mishnah and the Gemara describe that you have there's a minimum amount that you have to cut in order for it to be a valid bris milah, and then you can have extra shreds or pieces of skin that you cut off in order to make it nicer, in order to do the job completely. So the Mishnah and the Gemara discuss exactly under what circumstances you're allowed to do that extra cutting on Shabbos when you're not. So in that course of that, the Gemara mentions the point about doing mitzvahs beautifully. Tanya, zeh keli v'anveihu. The Pasuk says, actually, we say to Hashem, this is my God and I will v'anveihu. So that means v'anveihu, we're understanding as meloshen no, and meloshen beautiful. So it means hisno lefon of the mitzvahs, be beautiful before Hashem in the way that you do mitzvahs. As say the fun of sukkah na, so make for Hashem a nice sukkah, the lulav na, and a nice lulav and esrog, the shofar na, a nice shofar, tzitzis na, a nice tzitzis, which can mean the strings themselves should be nice, it can mean the beged should that they're attached to should be nice, etc. Sefer Torah na, of a uksoiv l'shmoi, and you write the sefer Torah l'shmoi b'dyoy na, with nice ink, not the cheap stuff, b'kulmus na, with a nice pen, and that can mean either the pen, should be nice, or ben yoyoda says it means really more that the writing, the pen itself, we don't care what it looks like really, but you should write in a beautiful ksav. The lavla uman, use an expert sefer, b'korche b'shiroi noin, and wrap up the sefer Torah with beautiful silks. So in every way possible, make the mitzvah beautiful. And Marsha brings it over here from the Chilta on that pasuk, that after all, vanvehu, on the faith, it means I should be beautiful. How can a person beautify himself before Hashem? So that's what it means to make his mitzvahs beautiful. Then the Gemara continues, Abba Sholem, Va'anvehu means Hebe Doimaloi. We can also understand the word Va'anvehu as being as short for Ani Vahu, I and he. So that means you should be like he, like Hashem. Means Hebe Doimaloi. Try to resemble Hashem's midas as much as possible. Mahu Chanun V'rachum, just like Hashem is merciful and kind. Afata Hey Chanun V'rachum, so also you should be kind and merciful, and the same thing with all the other midas of Hashem. So in fact, Maharsha says, really, you don't even have to say that. You don't even have to say, like Rashi, that Abishol is doubting the word vanvehu differently. He can mean that he agrees with Tanakama that vanvehu means I will make myself beautiful. But how do you make yourself beautiful? He's saying not just by making your mitzvahs beautiful, but also by making your midas tovas and your maisim beautiful. Mitzvah of the Hanas Nitnu just means, in other words, that the Hana that you gained, that you have from a mitzvah, for example, you hear somebody blowing the shofar and it sounds real nice, that doesn't count as a Hana such that, for example, if let's say you also have Hana from him, that you should be also to hear his shofar blowing, we say that's Lav the Hanas Nitnu because they're Gzeiras Melech. But nevertheless, the mitzvah itself should be done in the most beautiful possible way. Fine. Further on, it talks about that on the among the things you can do when you do a bris milah on Shabbos is afterwards you put a dressing on the wound. So that leads the Gemara into discussing a little bit about dressings for wounds in general. Amar Abaya, Amar Li Ein. My mother told me, and we find in Kiddushin that Abaya's mother actually passed away in childbirth. So throughout Shas, when he says Ein, he means his foster mother. So she told me, Isbalanisa de Kulukevi, the best dressing that you can use for any kind of wound, Shevmi Nai Tarba Vachad Kira, seven parts fat and one part wax. Rashi explains minai means like monos, means portion, so it means seven parts in one part. Rabbi Yaakov Emden says actually minai may mean different kinds, so it might mean, for example, like a fat from a from an ox and from a sheep and from a goat, etc., until you have seven different kinds, and then one measure of wax. Rava Amar Kira V'Kalba Rishina. Rava says actually the best thing would be Kira, which is wax, V'Kalba is tar or pitch that you get from wood. Rashi explains particularly, now you can heat the wood and you get tar from it, but the kind of tar we're talking about is the kind that oozes out of the wood naturally. So you have certain kinds like pine sap, certain kinds of pine sap or whatever, you get a certain sap from it that Rashi describes. It's white and it's white or clear or whatever, like turpentine or something. And so he says that plus wax is a good dressing for wounds. The word Rishina, by the way, is actually, it's funny, Rashi had put it in his translation as the French translation of the word kalba. It's actually a French word, Rishina, like in English we have the word resin, right? A later copyists or later printers thought that Rashi meant to say it belongs in the Gemara, and so they stuck it into the Gemara. So the Gemara continues, Dosha Rava B'Mechuzah. One time Rava publicly doushin about this in Mechuzah, about this prescription of his with the turpentine and the wax. Harinu b'nei Minyamin Astiel Amanaihu, the people of the household, Minyamin the doctor, ripped their clothing because now they were upset. Until now they had a nice thing going where people would come to them for remedies and they could prescribe this to them and people would pay them, and now they lost that source of income. But Rava told them, don't worry, I've left you over one thing. Even if you don't have that, you still have another thing, which another trade secret of yours, which I won't. If a person washes his face, and he doesn't dry his face afterwards very well, then he ends up getting on his face chaspenissa. Rashi gives two explanations. One is that he develops cracks in the skin of his face. And Rashi says another explanation is that it's some kind of boils on the skin. So it might be like acne or something. The Oruch gives yet a different definition, that it means like he develops like peeling, like the skin on his face starts peeling. Whatever the case, that's caused by leaving moisture on his face after he washes it in the morning. It could be psoriasis, I don't know, whatever. My takante, so how do you fix it up? If you have that, limshi tuva, maya basilka, afterwards wash your face very well with water with beet soup. with soup, with water in which beets were cooked, and that will help clear up whatever the outbreak was of, on the skin of the face. Peshet Agadta gives an interesting idea of the idea behind this. Of course, we have a lot of these remedies in the Gemara. It's hard for us to or impossible for us to apply nowadays. We have to understand the deeper reason behind it. He says basically that what Abaye's foster mother and what Rava are saying on a deeper level, they're talking about how a person has to deal with his midas rois, so cholokavi, any kind of sores or any kind of thing that a person has wrong with himself. He has to work on his midas. Therefore, they mentioned seven different things that you use corresponding to the seven midas, but Rashi makes a point of saying that the tar, that the turpentine or whatever that Rav is describing that you want to use should not be the kind that comes with fire, just the kind that oozes out naturally and the kind that's white or clear in color, representing those. You don't have to go about it in a fiery way, go about it in a calm way, dealing with your midas and fixing up what needs to be fixed up. So now these people of Minyam and Astia were upset, because now they were not just doctors of the body, they were also psychologists or whatever, helping deal with people with these kinds of things. So Rava tells them, I left you one trade secret, which is you can have a person washes his face, representing that he has been working on his midas, but he doesn't dry them. In other words, that now, so what happens if a person washes his face and doesn't dry it means, in other words, that in effect, like he's going around and everybody can see he just washed his face. So that represents that he's acting in a gaivadik way. Look what a great guy I am that I'm working on my midas. So the result is you can end up with acne or whatever, representing the gases or ruach. Therefore, what you should do is learn some musr, which is like beet soup. It's very sharp and very sharp and bitter, and that'll clear up the outbreak. Okay. Further on, the Mishnah describes now there are certain things that you can't do for the milah on Shabbos, because these kind of things could have been prepared before Shabbos. One of them is, in those days, they used to have a particular kind of remedy for a wound was they would mix together wine and oil very thoroughly, and then they would apply it to the area. So the Mishnah says you can't mix those together on Shabbos, because that would be clearly for refuah. So therefore, all you can do is you can apply them separately if necessary, but better you should prepare it before Shabbos. So in that connection, the Gemara mentions that you also have this kind of mixture, is also this kind of concoction is also used for other kinds of sick people. So the Gemara says, Tanya, ein turfin yayin b'shemen l'chodah b'shabbos. You're not allowed to blend together the wine and the oil for a sick person on Shabbos, let's say, for example, to apply to his stomach or whatever part of his body is aching. Omer b'shemen alazim, b'shem rameyu, af turfin yayin b'shemen, but b'shemen alazim says in the name of rameyu, you could. And after we learned earlier in the Masechta that there are many kinds of different things involving medications that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. The Chachamim were concerned that if you do it on Shabbos, you might come to grind spices for medications, and then you'd be over on a malacha d'araisa. So the mayor holds that that's not a problem with this kind of concoction, because that doesn't involve grinding anything. And the other Chachamim held that it's similar enough that we have to include it in the Gzeira. So Amar Reb Shimon Elazar, Pam Achas Chosh Reb Meir B'Meyav. One time Reb Meir had a stomach ache. We wanted to mix wine and oil for him. And he didn't let us. So we Talmidim said to him, should your own words, your own opinion become bottled during your own lifetime? You yourself said it's mutter. Why all of a sudden? No, you're changing your mind. He says, it's true that I say one way and my colleagues, the other Chachamim, say the other way, and I have every right to hold my opinion, but throughout my life, I never had the breakkeit to go, I never had the confidence to go against what my Chaverim say. So if they say that it's also, then I'm going to be machmer. And the Gemara points out, who knew to achmer on nafshe? So he's machmer on himself not to do it. Abul kula al mashori, implying that for everybody else, it should be mutter. And the Gemara goes on to point out that then in that case, it seems to contradict the Mishnah, because stam Mishnah Reb Meir. So in that case, if the Mishnah is saying you can't mix them, then and yet Reb Meir himself is saying you can, and the Gemara goes on to reconcile it. Okay. Piska, then another quotation from the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, "Ein oisim l'choluk chola," that on Shabbos you can't make a choluk for the milah. Now, a choluk is like a tube-shaped bandage that you would put on the milah afterwards. So you want to make sure, of course, you don't want the skin to grow. You don't want the skin to grow back over it. So you need some kind of thing to wrap around the aver itself, but to leave the tip exposed. Nowadays, they use gauze pads pretty much for the same purpose. But anyway, So you can't make one on Shabbos because you know that would be something you could have done before Shabbos. And the halacha we said at the beginning of the parak, Rabbi Eliezer holds that all machshirei milah you're allowed to do on Shabbos, but the halacha is not like him. Anything that could have been prepared before Shabbos has to have been done. So here, then the Mishnah says if you're going to do a bris on Shabbos, you don't have a chaluk, then you just use a regular piece of cloth. So Omer Abaya, Omer Li'aim. So my mother said to me, again, my foster mother, Hai choluk di'inuka, when you make this tube-shaped bandage for the Aver after the bris, Lefanya b'sitra le'iloi, make sure that the side with the hem should be folded outward. It shouldn't be touching the skin. Because otherwise, a thread from that hemmed edge might catch on the wound. And then later on, when you take it off to change the dressing, you might accidentally pull off part of the gid with it, and then the child will be injured. And if it's a severe enough injury, then it would be a krus shofcha even, and he's not even allowed to love a bakal. He's not allowed to marry a regular born Jewish woman. So therefore, in short, make sure that anywhere where there are loose threads is nowhere near the wound. So the Gemara says, this same foster mother of Abaya, when she would make the scholuk for babies that were getting there, that were getting a bris in her town, she would make inside of the dressing, she would put a lining halfway down. So that way, in other words, so you have the end of it. So the end of it that's going to be closer to the wound, the end of it that's going to be closer to the atara where the cutting of the bris was done, that end you're going to have the hem over there, and you have the concern with the loose threads that we're talking about. So she would sew a lining on the inside of that so that there's no loose threads there that could possibly catch. This way, even if the parents don't remember to fold it outward, like she was just saying, nevertheless, it won't cause a problem with krus shofcha because the lining will keep anything from catching. Amar Abaya, so further, Abaya says in this connection, Hai yinuka delesle choluk, what if you don't have a choluk, what if you don't have this tube-shaped dressing available? Lysi belisa, then take a worn-out garment. The point is that a new garment, a new piece of cloth is fairly stiff, so you want it to be a little bit used already, you want it to be a little worn and washed or whatever several times so that it'll be soft. The isle sifsa, it should have a hem on it. Again, you shouldn't have an end of it with loose threads that can easily come off. But if the sifsa v'tatori, wrap it around the gid in such a way that the part with the hem is towards the bottom, towards the body end of the gid. And then fold it out. Then you put it around the gid and fold the edges of it outward again, like we said, so no loose threads catch on to the wound. So better to use a choluk, which is made for that purpose. But if you don't have that, then you can use something like that in a pinch. And actually, again, when the Mishnah is saying if you don't have a choluk available on Shabbos, then what Abaya is saying would work for that as well. So by the way, here Abaya mentioned several other things that his mother told, that his mother, or rather his foster mother, told him as far as taking care of newborn children. Omrali aim, he says, my mother, my foster mother told me, Hai yinuka dele mayit, if a baby is not sucking, if a baby is not nursing, the reason is, I skipped one. Omrali aim, Hai yinuka dele yadia mapakte, if you have a baby where you can't clearly see his anus, so you have, there's supposed to be a hole over there for the waist to come out, and you can't find it clearly because it's covered with skin. What you should do is first smear it with oil, because oil tends to clarify things, so it'll help the skin be a little more translucent than it'll otherwise be. Then hold the baby up in the sunlight, and you'll see an area in that part of the body which is a little clearer, which is a little more translucent than the rest, because that'll be the area where the hole is. So the kara say the sa'arta shesi ve'erim. Then what you do is take a grain of barley, which has a sharp tip, and use it to cut that area, shesi ve'erev, crosswise. So now you have a proper hole over there, and now he'll be able to eliminate his waste. Why dafka a bit grain of barley? Ava b'klim machas loy, don't use a metal keli, like a knife, for that purpose, mishum dezorif, because it could cause an infection. A metal knife, after all, could carry germs on it, whereas a grain of barley is much less likely to. If you have a baby who's not sucking, he can't nurse. The reason is mekohu dekar pume. The reason may be because his mouth is cold. His lips are cold, so he doesn't have the energy to use the muscles of his lips and his gums and whatever to nurse. My takante, so what do you do? Lysi kosagumri, take a cup full of coals. Or Rashi seemed to have a slightly different girsa because he says you put a bunch of coals on a flat board or on a keli. So whatever, you pile up some coals over there. The linkate lelahadi pumi, put it near the baby's mouth. The chayim pumi, that will warm up the baby's mouth. Oh my, it's and now he'll be able to nurse. Peshraganta says a deeper thing behind this might be when you have a Talmud who's not learning, who's compared to a baby nursing, who's not learning properly from his Rebbe, it may be because he has a coldness to him, and therefore you need to warm him up with a little bit of chayus, give him a little bit of musr or whatever. He has to after all have sifsois of notfus mur, as the Gemara says in a different Gemara, that his lips should be dripping bitterness. He should have yira and then aim of a yira for Torah, and then he'll be able to learn properly. Next, the Omra Baya, Omra Li'em, Hai Yenuka Deleminashtin. If you have a baby who's not breathing properly, so Rashi explains that he doesn't have a pulse. He doesn't have a pulse. The Oruch gives a different explanation of it, that Leminashtin means that he can't urinate. So then, either way, Lenafe Benafvosa, what you should do is fan him with a fan. Umanashtim, and then he'll be able to breathe, or then he'll be able to urinate. But Omer Abaya, Omerly Aim, also my mother told me, Hi Yenuka Dolem, my foster mother, that is, Hi Yenuka Dolem Avi, if you have a baby, again, who's not, so Rashi explains that Ma'avi means he's not breathing properly. So the previous one, Menashtim, Rashi explained he didn't have a pulse. Here you're saying he has a pulse, but he's not breathing properly. According to the Aruch, that the first one meant that he's not urinating, then this one just means that this one means that he's not breathing. There's the word ma'avi in the Gemara sometimes also means crying, which they tend to go together. If a baby is able to breathe, then usually he'll cry as well. Anyway, so leisu shul yosa de'ime, you take the placenta that his mother bore together with him. And strictly speaking, the shulya is not just the placenta; it's the whole amniotic sac that the baby was in the womb. Anyway, you take that, the lishrike ale, and you rub it on the baby, umavi, and then he'll breathe, properly, or cry, or whatever it is. But Omer Abaya, and similarly, Abaya says, Omer Liyem, hi, you nuka tekotin, if the baby is too small, smaller than normal, leisu b'shoyosid ime, take the amniotic sac that came from the mother, the lishrike ilave, mikutna la'uma, and rub it on the baby in the direction from the small end to the large end. The Gemara explains in Nida, the Gemara discusses a little bit the structure of this thing, Nageya, as far as certain halachas of Tumah V'Tahara, that it mentions that one end of it is narrow, and then it widens towards the other end, and the narrow end is the Gemara says is the size of a gris, I think, or something, and then it widens towards the other end. So take it and rub it on the baby from the narrow end to the wide end, and that'll be like a sgula that now he should grow from being small to being large. The e alim, and if the baby is over large, then do the other way around, ma'umalakutna, then rub it on him in the opposite direction from the large end to the small end. Peshur Agadta explains with all four of these last ones that they all represent different things where a person is lacking something in his midas. You have it in Sfarim, mostly from the times of the Rishonim. You have talk about four different liquids in the body that affect a person's temperament. We use the word Mora Shchora, for example, to mean somebody who's depressed and melancholy, but you also have Mora Levona and Mora Aduma and whatever. And so he explains that each one of these refers to somebody who has an excess of one of those, and therefore the treatment that we're saying is appropriate to get the person back onto an even keel. Because we know, as the Rambam says, with almost all midas, a person should be on the midpoint between them. Okay. But Omer Abaya, then Abaya says another thing. Omer Li'em, hai yinuka de sumak, when a baby is too red, the reason is that katila ivla be doma, this blood has not yet been absorbed into his body. Right now, in other words, Rashi explains that right now his blood, instead of being in his muscles and in his blood vessels, whatever, it's all between his skin and his flesh. So if you make him a bris mila, at that point, too much blood is going to come out. Litru chole, they should wait with the bris mila, ad de ivla be dama, until the blood is properly absorbed, vilim hale, and only then should they do the bris mila. And vice versa, the yoruk, if the baby is yellowish, jaundiced, for example, da'katila nafal be dama, so there it's the other way around, that the blood hasn't properly developed in him yet, which actually that's modern medicine says much the same thing. When a baby has jaundice, it means basically the liver, which is responsible for producing red blood cells, among other things, is not fully functioning yet. Anyway, so you have the same problem. He's too weak. You have to wait until the blood fully develops in him, and only then do the bris milah. D'tanya, as in fact we learn in a braisa, Omer Rebbe, Omer Rav Nosson, Pam achas halachti l'krakei hayam, one time I went to the cities near the sea, that can mean the sea coast of Eretz Yisrael, or it can mean the sea coast of some other place, whatever. Obasa isha achas lefane, a woman came in front of me, shemala b'narushin v'mes sheni v'mes, she had mild her first son and he died on the second one also, shlishi aviatu lefane, now she had a third son, so she brought him to me to ask what to do. Re'isiv shu odin, I saw he looked very red. A mighty loss, I said, Hamtini Layachi Bola Baidama, wait until his blood is fully absorbed. Himtina Layach Nivla Baidama, Umalai. So then she did the Brismila, the Choya, and sure enough, he survived. While Yukurinos and Nosan Abavli Ashmi, they named that baby Nosan Abavli after me. Shuv Pamachas, then he says, another time, Halachdilam Dinas Kapudkia, another time I went to the country of Kapudkia, which is, there's various opinions where it is exactly. One possibility is it's in Turkey or Syria, another one is it's someplace in Egypt, whatever it is, anyway. Again, this woman had mild her first two sons and they had died. Shlishi of Yatulafanai, then she brought the third one to me, Re'isiv Shu Yorik, and I saw that he was yellow. I looked carefully at him and I saw that he would have no dambris. So first of all, so Rashi explains, there's two problems. Number one, for by the bris mila, you need blood to come out. Blood is an essential part of the bris. And number two, it would be dangerous for him. He's not strong enough. So I told her, wait until the blood develops in him. And he survived. And again, they named him Nosan Abavli after me. There's a Rishimis where the Rebbe talks about a deeper idea behind these two stories. He explains that Rav Nosson is gematria tough kuf, so that represents the 500 years Bein Ha'aretz Bein Ha'Rakia, that his job is to connect the world with other course. So first he's going to Krakei Hayam, which is a very lowly place for Ruchnius, and he finds this woman over there whose babies are very red, representing. So first, the first one was too much on the side of Chesed, the second one was too much on the side of Gvura, and Bekitzer, the red, the fact that the blood was not fully absorbed in him represents that his Beruchnius, it means the woman represents Knesset Yisrael, Jewish people of that area, it represented that they're too much into their Tivus Gashmius. So therefore, you can't do a bris mila to a person under such conditions. So he tells her, wait until you've weaned yourself off those Tivus Gashmius, then you'll be able to do a proper bris mila. And sure enough, and they named him Nosan Abavli to represent that this child is going to accomplish, like Rav Nosson himself, to be able to bring down all the course into the world and to be able to take Bavel itself, a lowly place, and bring it up to Kedusha. Then in the second place, he says he went to Kaputkia, which is the other way around. Kaputkia, we find actually their money is worth more, their currency is worth more than the currency of Eretz Yisrael, we find at the end of Ksubis. So it represents a place that Eber says where they're on a higher level of Ruchnius, but so high, in other words, that the woman over there representing Knesset Yisrael, they don't have enough to do with the world. You have to actually work with the world to make a Jidim Tachtonim. That's represented by there's not enough blood in the baby. So again, Rav Nosson says you have to wait until you develop a certain connection with the world, and then you can do a bris mila, then you can have the bris, then you can have the covenant with Hashem, and sure enough, it worked out, and again, they called the baby Nosson Abavli to represent that now he can accomplish in Avoda what Rav Nosson himself is accomplishing. What the mother bring him, not the father? So in terms of what the Rebbe is explaining in Rishimis, because the mother represents Knesset Yisrael, and the father does not. The pashtus, I guess the mother, is the one who knows more about what's going on with the babies. I don't know. Yom Yom Mashiach Gola, Yud Tesvav 7. Well, the Rambam writes in Igeres Teiman that he mentions a particular year, which he says Nevuah will return to the Jewish people, and then he says that return of Nevuah is a preface to Mashiach. The pasuk says, "V'nibu b'neichem of neisechem, your sons and daughters will say Nevuah." So now, So now you have, and in later times, you have Hashem reveal the secret to his servants, the Nevi'im of our generation, beginning from the time of the Baal Shem Tov, where there was no one like the Tzemach Tzedek describes about him. There was no one like him from the time of the Rishonim, with the tremendous Pilei Plois and Nisim that he and the Mezitra Magid were able to see from one end of the world to the other. They had the revealed to them the entire light that was created on the first day. And you have later on, Novi Mekirbach HaKamoni, you have the Nesi'im in every generation that are an outgrowth of Moshe in every generation. They are the Shiftayach, the Yetzayach of our generation, including, of course, the Rebbe himself. Halacha, we're continuing with the halachas of Maso Mata and of doing business honestly. So we were talking about weighing and measuring honestly. Now you have a din also, a person is not allowed to keep a false weight or measure in his house or in a store, even if he's not actually measuring with it. That itself would be a lie. Even if he's using it, for example, for a bucket for urine or something like that, because somebody might not know and might go measure with it. If you have, there are some places you have where the official scales, you go, for example, into some stores and the official scales have a sticker on them that says they were inspected by so-and-so from such and such government agency on this date, then it's fine if this particular one doesn't have that mark, because then nobody's going to use it. So then it would be fine. You can't use it for measuring, of course, but you're allowed to keep it around your house and use it for other purposes. Rav Hanan ben Akasha.